and is disgraceful, and it's really holds the possibility for the destruction of humanity.
All right, on that note, we're going to wrap up tonight's Spotlight. Thanks to activist and commentator Don DeBar, joining us from Austin, New York, and Richard Becker, anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition, joining us from San Francisco, and a special thanks for staying with us.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now, we enlighten you with verses 40 to 43 of chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. يا بني إسرائيل اذكروا نعمتي التي أنعمت عليكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وإياي فارهبون وآمنوا بما أنزلت مصدقا لما معكم ولا تكونوا أول كافر به ولا تشتروا بآياتي ثمنا قليلا وإياي فاتقون ولا تلبسوا الحق بالباطل وتكتموا الحق وأنتم تعلمون وَأَقِيمُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ وَارْكَعُوا مَعَ الرَّاكِعِينَ صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O children of Israel, call to mind my favor which I bestowed on you, and be faithful to your covenant with me. I will fulfill my covenant with you, and of me, me alone, should you be afraid. And believe in what I have revealed, verifying that which is with you, and be not the first to deny it, neither take a mean price in exchange for my communications, and me, me alone should you fear. And do not mix up the truth with the falsehood, nor hide the truth while you know it. And keep up prayer, and pay the poor rate, and bow down with those who bow down.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran continues its peaceful nuclear program in defiance of Western pressure. North Korea launches two more ballistic missiles into the sea, drawing warnings from neighbors, South Korea and Japan. And Ukraine restores electricity to almost 6 million people after massive Russian airstrikes. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
Head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the country's enrichment capacity is now twice as high as the total capacity since the early days of the peaceful nuclear industry. Mohammad Islami says a comprehensive document created for the development of domestic industries functions as the basis of Iran's nuclear industry. He emphasized that a generation of power by nuclear plants has yielded considerable economic benefits for the Islamic Republic. Tehran has already enriched uranium to a 60% purity. The nuclear advances are being made in response to the U.S. 2018 unilateral withdrawal from the Iran deal. Tehran has repeatedly stressed that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. We asked political commentator Scott Bennett how the West is projecting Iran's nuclear program in the eye of international community. Here's what he had to say.
But the nuclear issue is one of the triggers that they're trying to use to inspire fear into the Western public, engage in propaganda. However, we are in a very unique circumstance because, number one, this is a tremendous triumph for Iran. There should be parades and confetti and celebrations and amplification of this victory for Iran's scientific prowess and its political will to be able to press through the propaganda and the hysterics of the West and yield an incredibly valuable and urgently needed scientific breakthrough, and that is the use of nuclear power. And Iran also has a chance to re-engage Europe, who is shivering in the dark corners and freezing to death and starving to death, and say, Europeans, Iranians are leading the way for energy independence, and we want to help and come alongside Europe to help them rediscover the value of nuclear energy.
Two Palestinian brothers have been killed after they were run over by an Israeli settler in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinian brothers Mohammed and Mo'anad Mutayer were killed when an Israeli settler car ran over them and soon fled the scene near a checkpoint in Nablus. This is the latest in the long-running trend of Israeli settlers' violence against Palestinians. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slammed the killing. It said the Israeli regime lets the perpetrators get away with such crimes. Hamas added that these crimes will not stop the resistance of Palestinians. The Saudi-led coalition has once again blocked two Yemeni-bound fuel ships from unloading there in the port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni government has condemned the blockade as a violation of Yemen's sovereignty. Youssef Mari reports.
The Saudi-led coalition has once again detained two fuel ships, preventing them from reaching the crucial western port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni Petroleum Company says the two fuel vessels were detained despite obtaining the necessary permits and being cleared from inspection in the port of Djibouti.
Preventing fuel ships from entering Yemen continues to take its toll on the country's battered economy. It has led to an increase in food prices and basic supplies and has made life harder for the Yemeni people as Saudi Arabia continues its blockade.
Rashid Al-Haddad, an economic expert, says the seizure of the fuel ships is just one of many war tactics employed by the Saudi-led coalition to put pressure on the Yemeni people.
The Saudi aggression is always exerting effort to make life difficult for all Yemenis by depriving them of fuel resources. 70% of fuel enters the country through the port of Hodeidah, which affects 22 million people. The Saudi-led coalition is using this as a war tactic, not against Ansarullah, but against the Yemeni people as a collective punishment.
Considering the expected rise in shipping prices, Dalal, a local fruit merchant, says he will be forced to raise his prices if no fuel enters the country.
This watermelon is normally sold for 1,500 Yemeni riyals when fuel is available. However, whenever they prevent fuel from entering Yemen, the price of this watermelon increases from 1,500 to 3,000 Yemeni riyals.
This blockade has caused an economic crisis. The price of wheat and fuel have increased. We don't have anything, and we're not even being paid salaries. We're besieged from all aspects of life.
The Yemeni government says the illegal seizure of Yemeni oil is an act of war and a violation of Yemen's sovereignty, which will be met with force if continued. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula as the North allegedly fires two ballistic missiles into the Sea of Japan. The South Korean military says it detected launches from an area in Pyongyang province. Seoul added that it had strengthened its surveillance capabilities in cooperation with the United States and maintaining its full preparedness. The Sunday launches come days after North Korea tested a high thrust of solid fuel motor for a new weapon system. Pyongyang has conducted a number of missile tests this year, including an intercontinental ballistic missile. It says these are in response to the United States' growing presence in the region and its joint military drills with South Korea and Japan. Recently, the U.S. and its allies warned that Pyongyang is preparing to launch its first nuclear test since 2017. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent Frank Smith, who is joining us live from the South Korean capital, Seoul. Frank, tell us more about these recent ballistic missile launches by the North. What does it signify?
Well, this signifies a record number of missile tests from North Korea, including, as you mentioned, an intercontinental ballistic missile about a month ago that overflew Japan. It needs to be recognized that North Korea is broadening its missile capabilities, having recently tested submarine-launched ballistic missiles, hypersonic missiles, and cruise missiles. And again, this offers North Korea multiple methods of delivering potentially a nuclear warhead to its adversaries here in the region, South Korea, Japan, and American forces, as well as the American mainland. In particular, the test of the high-thrust solid fuel that you mentioned, the solid fuel motor that you mentioned, that would enable North Korea to have potentially an ICBM, a long-range missile, ready to be launched at any time. Right now, it uses liquid fuel in its previous tests. And this takes more time, hours, perhaps even days, to load that fuel into a long-range rocket. The solid fuel motor will, again, enable them to launch such a missile with little notice.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent Frank Smith from Seoul. Now, India's economy continues to be on a consistent track, and it is posting as the fastest growing among major economies. Experts say this would pave the way for the South Asian nation to become the world's third largest by 2030. Munawar Zaman reports.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world's second most populous nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak, mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Japan has approved a major defense policy overhaul that includes an unprecedented spending hike. The money will fund plans to buy missiles and reshape Japan's military command, among other things. The military buildup is the biggest Japan has announced since World War II in the face of potential enemies.
Japan is allocating $320 billion in an effort to build up its military, a move that would be unthinkable under previous administrations. But now, under the Liberal Democratic Party led by Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, surveys say the budget has the favor of over 70% of voters. The military developments include extending the range of Japan's missiles, stockpiling of spare parts and other munitions, reinforcing logistics, developing cyber warfare capabilities, and cooperating more with US and other like-minded countries. The extension of the range of Japanese missiles is only meant to be able to reach China if the need were to ever arise, as there is no other reason to extend the range to around 1,000 kilometers. The reason why Japan feels the need to advance its missile technology is the escalation of tensions in the Indo-Pacific region. North Korea has, on multiple occasions, tested intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads, one of which landed a little too close for comfort to Japan. The China-Taiwan tensions are also cause for concern for Japan, as a potential military escalation could put Japan in danger as well. This is because of the large number of troops and massive amounts of supplies that the U.S. has stationed in Japan, which they would most likely take advantage of in case of an escalation with Taiwan. Here's what Prime Minister Kishida said with regards to the military build-up plan.
We can feel a rapid increase in the severity of the security environment around our country. In countries and the regions surrounding our country, a strengthening of nuclear and missile capabilities, a rapid military build-up, and attempts to unilaterally change the status quo through power are becoming more pronounced.
Kishida also emphasized on the issue of China as a challenge to its security. He said, China's current external stance and military trends are a challenge to our country's peace and security, the securing of global peace and stability, and the enhancement of international order based on the rule of law. To which Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin responded by saying, Japan disregards the facts, deviates from the common understandings between China and Japan, and its commitment to bilateral relations, and discredits China. Japan even believes that Russia is a threat to its security, albeit indirectly. Tokyo sees Russia's war in Ukraine as a dangerous precedent that might encourage China to carry out a similar operation in Taiwan and cause unimaginable disruption to world trade. By taking stances against North Korea, China, and Russia, Japan must look to the U.S. and South Korea as its allies.
The European Commission president has hailed an energy deal inked with four countries in the Caucasus. The bloc is scrambling to diversify its energy away from Russian sources.
This agreement will bring the European Union closer to our partner in the South Caucasus region, and it will both help our regions achieve the clean energy transition. The European Union has been able to compensate the cuts in Russian pipeline gas, but this is not just about handling a new geopolitical energy situation. It is also about grounding our future in clean, affordable, and secure energy sources. And this is why the Black Sea electric cable between Romania, Georgia, and Azerbaijan is so important. And I can only say, what an ambitious project. It would connect us on both sides of the Black Sea and run further towards the Caspian Sea region.
Von der Leyen added that the power line can potentially feed electricity to Moldova, the Western Balkans, and Ukraine as well. She made the announcement during a signing ceremony with leaders of the four nations in Bucharest. Under the agreement, Azerbaijan will supply Europe with electricity through a new undersea cable. The project is to be funded in large part by the EU and is expected to be completed in 6 years. Europe is grappling with an energy crisis due to reduced supplies from Russia. Moscow cut off its supplies, blaming technical issues created by Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine. Ukraine says it has managed to restore power in some regions after Russian missile strikes on Friday.
The main thing today is the energy sector. Over the day, we have managed to bring electricity back to almost 6 million Ukrainians. Repair works are ongoing now. They continue without interruption after yesterday's terrorist attack.
Zelensky also added that there are big problems with the supply of heat and water. He also urged Western allies to give Ukraine a reliable air defense shield. The Ukrainian president said Kiev and its surrounding regions are the hardest hit, and in other regions, there are large-scale outages. Earlier, Russian Defense Ministry spokesman said the strikes have prevented delivery of foreign-made weapons and ammunition. The chief commander of Ukraine's armed forces says 60 of 76 Russian missiles were intercepted and destroyed, yet they took a heavy toll on the infrastructure. The two people were also killed during a strike on a residential building.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Leaders meeting with members of the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution. On Tuesday, 6th of December 2022, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with members of the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. On Tuesday, 6th of December, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with members of the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution in Tehran. The Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution was formed back in 1984 under orders of the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. The council was formed because Western culture had permeated Iran, particularly in the years before the Islamic Revolution, during the Shah's reign. part of Imam Khomeini's order, which led to the establishment of the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution, stated, "A huge effort is needed to uproot Western culture, which teaches us all the wrong stuff, and replacing it with proper Islamic culture, which teaches us good things. A huge effort is needed throughout the country in all areas for many long years in order to combat and diminish the influence of Western culture, which runs deep. Just as everyone knows, culture is the identity of a nation. Cultural values point to the spirit and true meaning of a nation. The society, the economy, the politics, and even the defense forces of a nation are influenced by its cultural values. Thus, it is misguided to think that the culture of a nation takes shape in the correct manner and in the correct path. Rather, planning is needed. The Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution's main role is to guide the culture of the people of Iran. Its raison d'etre is to promote Islamic culture in society, particularly in universities, schools, and institutes of higher education." Beginning of his speech, the leader emphasized that it is necessary for the country's cultural structure to undergo a revolutionary reconstruction. He said, "By observing and recognizing the weaknesses and false cultural ideas in different areas, the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution needs to provide wise solutions for propagating correct ideas and forward-moving concepts." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the presence of prominent elite academics and experts in the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution, adding, "Despite the elevated high status of the individuals present in this council, the collective identity of the Supreme Council has not demonstrated itself in the way that it is required. It is necessary for the council to strengthen its influence in the country's cultural affairs. Of course, members of the council have other jobs, and it is not expected that they refrain from undertaking their main duties. However, we expect that they allocate a suitable and sufficient amount of time for the Supreme Council's affairs." Moving on to the question of what the duties of the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution are, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The Council's most important role and responsibility is to guide the culture in the country and society." He emphasized that the method of cultural guidance for government organizations is different from cultural guidance by non-governmental organizations and grassroots organizations. He explained this by saying, "By correctly guiding thousands of non-governmental organizations and grassroots organizations that are undertaking diverse, extensive cultural activities, the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution can prepare the foundation for the formation of a public movement with regards to important issues, such as spreading the culture of living simply and combating waste and lavish lifestyles." The leader believes that these kinds of public movements for raising people's awareness and correcting misguided cultures are a part of cultural engineering. With regards to the guidance of government cultural organizations, the leader said, "In the case of organizations such as the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, the Ministry of Education, the Islamic Development Organization, and the IRIB, you cannot guide a culture by just issuing documents for reform. These documents must be realized and implemented, and the heads of the three branches of the government need to be present in the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution meetings in order to guarantee their implementation." The leader also referred to the matters he spoke about last year during his meeting with cabinet ministers regarding the need for a revolutionary reconstruction of the country's cultural structure. He said, "What is meant by structure is the cultural structure of society and the mentality and culture that governs it. Succinctly, it is the culture that people in society base their actions upon in their individual and collective lives." He explained that the reason for a revolutionary reconstruction of the cultural structure is due to the fact that Islamic revolution brought about miracles through the leadership of the late Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, and the efforts of the Iranian people, and it changed the political, cultural, and social foundations of Iran, and changed the misguided and false ideas in people's minds. The leader of the Islamic Revolution further stated that the culture of saying, "We can't," is one of the false ideas that prevailed in society before the Islamic Revolution. He poignantly added, "The Islamic Revolution gradually changed this mindset with its constructive work and creative movement, which led to the major accomplishments such as construction of dams, construction of electricity-generating power plants, highways, oil and gas industry equipment, and major infrastructure. These projects were carried out by young Iranian experts." The leader also stressed that the culture of infatuation with the West and even the use of foreign words to be another misguided culture that had been common in society. He explained that it was the Islamic Revolution that changed this incorrect mindset and transformed this culture into a culture of objecting to the West. The leader also regarded the shift from a culture of egocentrism and seeking fame to a culture of sacrifice and selflessness to be an example of the cultural impact of the Islamic Revolution on people's personal lives. He underlined that despite the change of many incorrect foundations, various factors weakened the determined spirit of the revolution over time. Therefore, this issue is something that must be carefully monitored to prevent the reappearance of those misguided cultural ideas. The leader added that the revolutionary culture and spirit can be revived once again, and that a great cultural movement can be created with the help of intellectual foundations of the revolution and the younger generation. The leader believes that this issue is one of the essential tasks that needs to be undertaken by the Supreme Council of the Cultural Revolution. He emphasized that the council must think, work, and plan in order to do this. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei pointed out that constant monitoring of the usually hidden cultural changes and timely tackling of problems is essential for the revolutionary reconstruction of the country's cultural structure. He said, "If we're weak and backward in continuously understanding these changes and preventing their negative effects, our society will definitely be harmed. Cultural turmoil or control of the country's cultural affairs falling into the hands of others are the most important of these harms." The leader stated that correct cultural engineering is a necessary fundamental task for reforming the cultural structure of the country. He pointed out that constant vigilance, accurate recognition of cultural weaknesses in areas such as society, politics, family, lifestyle, and other areas, as well as efforts to find wise solutions to eliminate weaknesses and promote a correct cultural mindset are some of the basic requirements for the country's cultural engineering. He said that cultural engineering has led to the clarification of the work that needs to be done by various organizations, such as the Ministry of Education, IRIB, in higher education, in centers relating to young people and the youth, and also in non-governmental organizations. He warned that if these organizations neglect their duties, society will suffer tremendously. The leader stressed the urgent need for scientific progress. He also praised the outstanding results that have been achieved due to an increase in the prevalence of the mindset of wanting to cross borders of knowledge in the past 2 decades. The great leap forward in scientific and technological areas was one of the blessed effects of this great movement, he said, and that this must continue. The leader stressed that universities, scientific and research organizations, and related institutions should make scientific progress their top priority.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we'll look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. On today's show, we'll be talking about the hijab and the debate regarding hijab laws in Muslim countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran. So let's kick off this episode with a deep dive into the violent protests which have emerged following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini in September of this year. Her death saw a rapid rise in Islamophobic anti-hijab sentiment being expressed by the various radical groups who seem to have hijacked her name as part of a movement campaigning for the destruction of Islam in Iran and elsewhere.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has come under a sustained attack from a persistent, violent protest movement in recent weeks, with anti-Iran demonstrators seemingly obsessed with criticism of Iran's laws on modesty and compulsory hijab. The riots first broke out in Iran in mid-September after the death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini. The 22-year-old fainted at a police station in Tehran and was pronounced dead 3 days later in hospital. An official report by Iran's legal medicine organization concluded that Amini's death was caused by illness, rather than alleged blows to the head or other vital body organs. However, her death was quickly adopted as a means by various groups to attempt to topple the government.
They've got an agenda. I feel like they are well supported by the British, by the West, by the Israelis, and that's why they're here.
Footage has gone viral showing protesters burning hijabs, attacking mosques, and desecrating spiritual artwork. In response to the violence, millions of Iranians have marched across Iran over multiple occasions this year, defending the hijab and condemning attacks against Iranian security forces by demonstrators. The unrest has been used as a precursor to renew Western debate over Iran's mandatory hijab laws and women's rights from a Western perspective.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about the importance of the hijab in Islam and the anti-Iran protests, we have Sister Batul Subaiti, a political activist and commentator based here in London. And also joining me is Sheikh Taqi Jafar Razawi. He is a scholar based in London who has been involved in Islamic dissemination amongst the youth for the last three decades and works in community activities, both religious and social. Thank you to both of you for joining me on the show, and salamu alaikum to you both. Perhaps I could come straight to you, Sayyid, and ask you about what does Islam say about the hijab? What's the position of the hijab in Islam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think what's really important to understand, hijab is not a item of just clothing, but it's a existence of an individual in relation to what they can associate with and cannot associate with. And Quran and various aspects of the Quran and traditions quite clearly talk about association in the sense of mahram and non-mahram, in other words, those who are immediate family and those who are not immediate family. And that's where the hijab comes in, because whilst one associates with immediate family, in other words, the various parts of the ayat of the two ayats mainly in Surah Nur, which is the 24th Surah of the Quran, mm-hmm. which ayat number 30 and 31, in which they quite clearly say, I mean, there's the ayat which says to the men that they should lower their gaze, and there's the ayat number 30 which says to the women that they should lower their gaze. Whilst Islam does say, I mean, the ayat which is number 31, quite clearly says that who one can interact with. It says that you can interact with you can appear without a hijab with your husbands, your husband's father, your husband's sons. All those interactions also have their own categories. You know, like you have a female who can appear in a particular manner in front of her husband, she cannot appear in that particular manner in front of her father. And society would condemn the woman if she tried to appear in the manner that she appears in front of her husband, as she would appear in front of her father. When society has these prerogatives and previously set standards, Islam goes a little bit further and says, look, because women are not just left to be locked up in the home, they will interact with men, they will interact with people who are not their mahram, not their immediate family. Therefore, when that takes place, then Islam says, well, make sure that you then interact with in such a manner that you will not be infringing the rights of those who are not your mahram to see you, and likewise you will not be found, you will not be doing something which is contradicting your religious responsibilities in relation to interaction. And that ayat which I said, the 30th ayat of Surah An-Nur, it says to men as well, that if they come across women who are not their immediate families, immediate relatives, then they too must lower their gaze.
So it seems to me like the concept of hijab is quite differently seen. It's a different perspective from the Muslim world. It's about protecting the woman and giving her an opportunity to enter into the public space in a protected manner. I'm going to come to you, Sister Batul, now and ask for your opinion. You're obviously a practicing hijabi. You wear it quite proudly, I see. Could you just tell me, are you oppressed?
That's very funny, actually. The whole crux of the hijab is to free you from everything apart from God and submission to God. So the primary reason for why I wear the hijab is out of sheer and pure obedience to God. So I view it less as a choice of how to dress and more of a choice of whether or not I'm submitting to God the Almighty. From a secondary perspective, also just to echo what the Sayyid was saying, I do believe the hijab is an essential component of a healthy society. For me personally, I believe it has prevented me from being in many otherwise unideal or harmful situations. Of course, being a representative of Islam, it always keeps me in check. I believe it has also protected me from the lustful gaze of men. I also believe it's a protection for men themselves to not fall prey to that due to the way that God has created both males and females. I also believe the essence of the hijab is to restore equality between the males and the females. It's to remove the element of discrimination that relegates a woman's potential and worth to her level of sexual attraction. So essentially, it's there to facilitate the interaction of women and their participation in wider society rather than to limit. And I'll end by saying also that I think the body is a very private entity and reality of a woman. It should be respected. It should be honoured. Mm-hmm. And the whole essence of the hijab is to basically ensure that it's safeguarded, both the body and the soul, from moral corruption.
Because I know that the other side of the argument might suggest, well, actually, it's liberating for a woman to wear less rather than more. What's your response to that?
I mean, that's very funny, I would say, because actually a tool of social control, and the capitalists themselves and those at the top, they actually relish out of creating money from this industry of sexualizing women and actually utilizing women for their own satisfaction. The hijab comes and says, do you know what? We want you to be the most effective when you interact with society. So this is how you should interact to minimize instincts, because you are worthy as an entity and your output for society is what worthy, not the way that you look.
Fantastic. And Sayed, let me come back to you on this. About the hijab again, I wonder about what Islam's position is on the fact that there are laws in Muslim countries, Muslim majority countries, which are now in place, which basically make women have to wear it in the public space, even women who potentially don't want to wear it if given the choice. What's the Islamic view on that? Should that be the case in Muslim majority countries?
I mean, look at her tradition from Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salaam Alayha. When she was passing away, she writes a will to Mawla Ali, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, and she says that when my body is being carried, I don't want to be carried with just a sheet on my body, for I will be visualized by people who will see my body being carried to the grave. I want to be put in a tabut. I want to be put in a coffin, such that my respectability, even to my death, is kept to me, not enabled others who want to abuse that respectability that the Holy Prophet had granted me be seen and visualized. And what the sister says is quite interesting, that then it's important. There's a tradition from Mawla Ali. He says a female should keep herself busy in demonstrating obedience to the Creator, rather than be busy in how she impresses her appearance to others. And that's a very important tradition, because in obedience to the Creator, every aspect of one's behavioral life then is generated around that of protecting oneself to be close to the Creator, rather than close to the eyes of those who want to abuse the appearance of the individual. So these traditions are quite strong. I mean, and then, of course, we have the issues regarding Karbala, where Imam Hussein's family was taken as asir, as prisoners, to Yazid's audience. And there, even the ladies were trying to hide behind each other to prevent themselves from being seen by those present in Yazid's domain. So, you know, that aspect of self-protection is more in the definition, rather than be defined as mandatory imposing of something.
And I just want to make this point very clear as well. How important is the hijab in Islam? Because I know that there might be kind of like a reformist mentality coming out of the West now, where even among Muslims they're arguing, well, how important is the hijab? Do I really have to wear it?
You see, hijab, or a clothing of modesty, was something which even in the West was well respected. Even in the Victorian, they would say, oh, that's Victorian and now we're progressing. But the point is, it's not the issue of the item, it's the changing of its use, where the liberation is being given to take the woman out of dressing. But it's really interesting. One of these Somalian ladies was being given a award in the United Nations, and she went in her full hijab. So somebody asked her, why are you in hijab? So she says, you know, in the times when people were walking around without clothes, we called them barbaric. Mm. And now you want me to return to the environment of the barbaric lives where I'm without clothes? That is the reality.
That's an interesting point, yes. Yeah, it's a double standard.
It's double standard
there.
Because whilst you are promoting the removal of barbaric appearance, you're telling people who are in decent appearance to become barbaric.
Yes, it's double standards there. We're going to continue this discussion. Okay, before we continue our discussion on the hijab and Islam, let's have a look at some other Islamic stories that have been trending lately. The US men's football team have caused outrage by displaying Iran's national flag on social media without the Allah emblem of the Islamic Republic. Ahead of the two nations' recent World Cup match, the US team also said they support so-called protesters in Iran. According to FIFA regulations, the US soccer team should have been punished with a 10-match suspension for violating Iran's religious identity, but this didn't happen. Newly released census data shows that there are now 3.9 million Muslims in England and Wales, an increase of 1.2 million people over the last decade. This means there are now around 4 million Muslims living in the UK if the Muslim populations of Scotland and Northern Ireland are taken into account. London is the place with the highest concentration of Muslims. There are now over 1.3 million Muslims living in the British capital. And Islamic Party PAS has emerged as one of the biggest winners in Malaysia's general election, which was won by the reformist candidate Anwar Ibrahim. PAS, which has long been a powerhouse in northeast Malaysia, is now a national force by winning the most seats of any party. It espouses Islamic law for Malaysia, which runs contrary to Anwar's vision of a multicultural society. Protests against Islam and Iran have remained ongoing for a number of weeks, and not that long ago, I decided to attend one of these rallies in London, which luckily didn't turn violent, but gave me a chance to find out who are the protesters and what are the ideologies we're dealing with as part of this movement.
Few could be surprised about the regime change mission of the anti-Iran protesters. But what may be lesser known is the militant Islamophobic Western ideologies, which have essentially hijacked Mahsa Amini's name to further their own personal agendas. At one of the London rallies, it was clear that each protester had their own views on what they ultimately wanted to force onto Iranians. Militant Western feminism, LGBT activists, and Kurdish nationalism, just a few of the ideologies which had clearly linked up to push their own self-centred worldviews onto Mahsa Amini and the anti-Iran movement as a whole, with the ambition to ultimately destroy one of the Middle East's Islamic republics.
Welcome back to the discussion now, where I've been discussing the hijab and Islam with my two expert guests. Now, I'm going to come straight back to you, Sister Batul, about what's happening here. So I spoke to some of these activists. It's quite clear that they want much more for Iran than just freedom and human rights and so on and so forth. They want things like regime change. They want the rainbow propaganda machine to be flying the flag in Tehran, that type of thing. A lot of militant feminists want to completely remove clothes entirely, which I think is a bit too far even for some liberal standards. Just tell me, why is the hijab specifically the kind of target for these type of radical Western groups? Why are they burning it?
Right, because it's ultimately the symbolism of the hijab in terms of what it is representing. Now, I don't think they have a problem in and of itself with the practice of the hijab per se as a practice. Rather, it is the spirit of Islam. It is the spirit of Islam that says no to any form of cultural hegemony or submission to the dictates of any oppressive law or man-made law that is outside of the trajectory of God's law. So essentially, that is the crux of the issue that they have. So the way that I look at them is that these individuals are brainwashed, and these individuals have fell into the trap of the soft war campaign of the West, that inherently the reason that it attacks Iran is because Iran has this strong, independent line. And ultimately, the West wants the whole trajectory of the world to submit to their cultural hegemony and to their dictates and to their rules. So I think naturally, in that circumstance, it would view the hijab as a threat in terms of being the symbol for a true free Islam. So, for example, you won't see them complain about the hijab in Saudi Arabia, for example, because Saudi Arabia essentially is acting as a client state for the US. So they don't have a problem with that kind of hijab. They have a problem with the spirit that accompanies the true philosophy and embodiment and practice of the hijab, that is submission to none other than God. And they are the hegemons of the world, and they want to maintain that unjust status quo. So naturally, the real philosophy of the hijab will be a threat to them.
And how important do you think the hijab has been with, you know, with Islam in general in countries like Iran? How important is it for the national identity there?
Absolutely. As I have just mentioned, you know, the true embodiment of the hijab is one of freeing the individual from all that restricts them and ultimate submission to God. And that is the trajectory that Iran has taken in 1979. So I would argue that Iran, the Islamic Republic, is a true Islamic Republic in the real sense of the world, because this was the will of the people. The strength of the system in Iran ultimately rests on the people. You know, it was the people that came out on the streets and said, no East, no West, Islamic Republic. And you had a 98% votes for this, with a 90% voter turnout. And ultimately, the only reason that Iran is standing today is because of the people. Because if we look at 40 years of embargoes, sieges and sanctions and conspiracies of the worst kinds, from assassinations to defamation campaigns to a literal military campaign for 8 years in the Iran-Iraq war, all of that is designed to do what? It's designed to crush the spirit of the Iranian people. But ultimately, not only has that not succeeded, it has backfired. Today, Iran has the strongest, I would argue, economy in the world because it's self-sufficient, because it's reliant upon itself. Now, what does it mean to be reliant upon itself? It means it's reliant on its domestic capabilities. So no matter how many times we see these protesters coming out, another great evidence is that you will see 10 times the amount of these protesters coming in Iran to defend the ideals of the revolution. We see this on the anniversary of the revolution in Behman. We see this during Al-Quds Day, which is reaffirming the values of the revolution. We see this when individuals are assassinated, you know, whether it's Haj Qasem Soleimani, who's considered a national hero, or Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was a nuclear scientist, for example. These are all evidence and indicators that truly the system rests on the people, and they are a minority who are protesting.
I think it's also really interesting that there's clearly double standards at play here, because a lot of these movements are condemning Muslim countries for basically being Muslim, but then they're not speaking up for women who, Muslim women living in Europe, for example, right, who are being told, no, you can't wear the burqa, you can't wear the hijab in some circumstances, and basically oppressing their rights to choose what they want to wear. So blatant hypocrisy in that standard as well. Sayed, I'm going to come back to you on this. There are clearly debates going on, even among Muslims, regarding the hijab and so on and so forth. It's a challenge, I think, for Muslims in the West specifically to have to wear it, to have to live an Islamic lifestyle among non-Muslims amid the Islamophobic atmosphere that we live in as well. What's your advice to women who are perhaps struggling with this issue of the hijab?
I think main important thing is that one establishes one's own religiosity about what this is all about, you know, because as there was just a report recently which said that, you know, now the level of Christianity is also dropped below 50% in the community. That's yes, because they're identifying themselves more with atheism and consequently the disobedience to the Creator. And hijab and all these other aspects of self-protection is something which is a universal thing. You know, in Surah Shams, Quran says, فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has inspired the soul to understand good and bad. And understanding good and bad is within the domains of the environment that one is living in. That when one sees suppression of women's rights, in the sense of Islam doesn't say, it doesn't talk about equality, Islam talks about equity, in the sense of that which is the rightful, that which is a right of the individual to have, not that which is just given to the person because somebody else feels that is somebody's right to have. And that's where it's so important that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's understanding of human needs are quite clearly nurtured in the behavior of the human being and how they behave with people around them. Obviously, as not only just in Britain and how, or in Western countries where Muslim women are stressed in trying to identify themselves as an identity of what form they should take, it's something which has been imposed in Muslim countries during the time of the colonial powers, and how they made people unhijabbed, in the sense how they promoted women who were more freer to hang around with colonial powers. Then they gave them more powers and more positions. And they used women as tools of espionage in Muslim countries to get, I mean, one of those individuals who was well known for her espionage and behavior was Gertrude Bell. And how she interacted without hijab, so as to say, within the Muslim elite, pulling the elite towards the desire to have worse social behaviors than to promote good social behavior. And of course, the strength of the Islamic leadership in the form of the Maraji, who gave the rulings of how important the hijab is for sisters to possess for themselves, that played a major part in making sure that we understood how we should interact with the item of protection.
For sure. Now, we haven't got very long left of the show, so I'm going to come back to you, sister, for a final take. Could you just tell me about how is it that Mahsa Amini, I've never met Mahsa, but she doesn't seem like, you know, a militant Western feminist advocate to me. How is it that her name, her brand, became hijacked essentially by these Western groups?
Right. I think by now people probably know that there were 275 million tweets in the name of Mahsa Amini. That is not normal. that magnitude of systemic campaign and aggression against the Islamic Republic on Iran on something that was supposedly alleged tells you that surely there's a greater game at play here. Ultimately, I don't believe that the West is hell-bent, quote-unquote, on regime change in Iran. And the reason I will say this is because they're not naive. They know Iran has reached a position of strength where there is no going back, essentially. They've tried every single means and tactics that exists for them to fragment the nation. I mean, we saw this with the 2009, quote-unquote, Green Revolution, right? We saw that when the moment tens of Iranians came out on the streets when they felt like there might be a threat on the government, that they ultimately drowned those protesters. We saw that. So ultimately, what the West is seeking to do right now is to apply internal pressure through unleashing its underground collaborator networks and their underground hidden cells in order to wreak havoc, to pressurize Iran, so perhaps it might be able to get some concessions on an international scene. It was a pretext to also put sanctions, for example, on Iran to weaken it. But it's not, quote-unquote, regime change.
Basically using day tactics to try and get what they want out of Iran. And I think it's worth mentioning that there were huge protests in support of the Islamic Republic during this whole affair. That's something worth mentioning as well. But thank you very much to both of my guests today. It's been a very enlightening discussion, to say the least. But that's all the time we have for this edition of Eye on Islam. But join us next week for another edition. And for now, Salaamu Alaikum.